Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Dr. David Satcher. Dr. Satcher is a physician, a public health administrator, and a renowned champion for eliminating racial and ethnic disparities in health and for achieving healthy lifestyles through physical activity and through good nutrition. Dr. Satcher served as the 16th Surgeon General of the United States and the 10th Assistant Secretary for Health in the Department of Health and Human Services. He's also served as Director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In 2006, Dr. Satcher established the Satcher Health Leadership Institute at the Morehouse School of Medicine. The Institute is working to improve public health policy and to eliminate health disparities for disadvantaged groups. So now, Dr. Satcher, my dad and I feel so grateful for your decades of service, and we're so deeply honored to have you with us. And now for this interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean. Thank you, Dave, for being with us. We really appreciate your wisdom and the opportunity to share it with our audience.
I'm delighted to be able to join you, and I appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you. Well, I'm thinking back. The first official report from the Office of the Surgeon General was the landmark report issued in 1964 by then Surgeon General Luther Terry that dealt, of course, with tobacco and health. Prior to that, there had been a great deal of debate about whether smoking was safe or harmful, and 43% of Americans smoked. Today, 18% of Americans smoke. At least 8 million lives have been saved, and now nearly everyone recognizes the very serious health hazards from smoking. David, when you were Surgeon General, you issued one of the other great landmark Surgeon General's reports, this one on overweight and obesity. One of the things that strike me about your report is that although obesity is not an infectious disease, you called it, and I think quite rightly, an epidemic. What led you to use that term, epidemic?
Well, as you know, as director of the CDC, I had worked with a lot of people who had been involved with infectious diseases. And so you're right. We usually have reserved that term epidemic for infectious diseases that were increasing rapidly throughout the population. But then when we looked at this whole issue of overweight and obesity, especially among children, we saw that between 1980 and 2000, there had been a tripling of overweight and obesity. So that certainly meets the definition of an epidemic, anything that increases that rapidly. And so we felt comfortable, and I say we, I'm including the top scientists at the CDC. I was with one of them earlier this week, Bill Dietz. We felt comfortable in calling it an epidemic.
Well, your wording and your warning was prophetic. Obesity has now come to rival tobacco as the leading preventable cause of disease in this country. One would hope that physicians, along with other healthcare providers, would educate patients and potential patients about the importance of good nutrition and regular physical activity. But we have a disease-oriented healthcare system. Now, you have noted some years back that physicians could not be reimbursed for time spent helping patients lose weight because obesity was not defined as a disease. David, in the years since you said that, has obesity been formally considered a disease for the purpose of physician reimbursement?
Well, yes, and I think the Affordable Care Act also has made it much easier for physicians to be appropriately reimbursed for time spent with patients preventing complications of diseases. Now, the Medicare, for example, certainly rewards physicians who can demonstrate that their patients' diabetes or obesity or what have you has improved and that they are, in fact, controlling the disease and giving the patient a better outcome. So we've come a long ways in terms of reimbursing patient care for outcomes and not just numbers of times that the physician sees the patient. It's a big difference in terms of being able to look at the quality of outcomes of interaction and to reward physicians for that, as well as the fact that they saw the patient.
So there has been progress on that front. I know that eliminating health disparities has always been a priority for you. We still have enormous disparities in access to health care, in quality of health care, and in access to good food and in access to healthy environments. The Republican-led Congress has vowed to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. David, what has the Affordable Care Act meant to communities of color and to anyone in underserved communities and to rural communities as well?
Well, I think that the Affordable Care Act has really brought us to a new level of health care responsibility and, I would say, caring. There are 20 million people who are now covered because of the Affordable Care Act. We have dramatically decreased the percentage of the uninsured in this country to the lowest level in our recent history. It's made a big difference. But more important than that, and we don't talk about it enough, it's also changed the way we approach patient care. For example, as you know, there was a time just recently when patients would not be insured if they had a pre-existing conditions, whether it was a mental health problem or diabetes or what have you. And so many families face a situation where they couldn't get insurance for children with disabilities. And I'm including in that mental health problems, obesity, but pre-existing conditions meant that people had trouble getting insurance coverage. The Affordable Care Act changed all of that. The Affordable Care Act made mental illness a health service essential. In other words, it said it is essential that people get health care for mental disorders. And again, the number of families that have benefited from that is just amazing. So there were a lot of good things that came out of it. The fact that children can stay on their parents' insurance until the age of 26. It made a tremendous difference in coverage. You know, millions of people being able to keep their coverage, whereas they would have lost it. So a lot of good things about the Affordable Care Act. I think the Affordable Care Act is the kind of thing that needs to continue to be reformed and improved. And I think that should be our attitude, is that where can we find areas for improvement. But nobody can argue that when it comes to coverage and access or even sensitivity to the plight of people and families, the Affordable Care Act has moved us forward tremendously. Not perfect, but really, given all that's been accomplished, if we could continue to reshape it and reform it, I think we could have a great health system in this country, healthcare system.
If you had the power to reshape and reform it and help it to improve, what steps would you have us take?
Well, one of the things that I would be most concerned about is the extent to which we are implementing the prevention agenda. I think the prevention agenda was built into the initial proposal as a way of decreasing costs in the health system. And there's a lot of evidence that prevention agenda will do that. It has not been well-funded. It has not been supported. There are people who feel that, quote, prevention is an individual responsibility, so the health system should not be involved with that. I totally disagree. I think if we invest in prevention, we're going to decrease the cost of treating diabetes. When I was director of the CDC, and I'll make this brief, we went to Speaker Gingrich about what was going on in the Native American population, and all of the people there suffering from end-stage renal disease related to diabetes. And we asked him if he would really help the CDC implement a program that really attacked diabetes from the standpoint of prevention and control as a way of dealing with the end-stage renal disease in the Native American population. Well, about a month ago, the study came out showing that Native Americans now have a lower end-stage renal disease rate than any population in the country. It's right there. The white population is about the same, but it's the curve has been completely downward in terms of end-stage renal disease for Native Americans. It's one of the most important success stories that we have. But so we need to focus on prevention and control, and in time, that will help to control the cost.
When you talk about prevention, which is clearly an ounce of prevention, it is said, is worth a pound of cure. That's really where we get the most bang for the buck in prevention.
Well, you know, at the CDC, we used to say an ounce of prevention is worth a ton of cure.
A ton of cure. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. Well,
believe that.
The Obama administration made reducing obesity a priority during its 8 years in office. It created a task force on childhood obesity. It overhauled nutrition requirements in school lunches. It passed requirements for calories to be labeled on menus. And it moved to ban trans fats from foods. But despite these efforts, obesity rates among adults continued to climb during the Obama years from about 33.7% when Obama first took office to 38% or so when he left. Now, the Republican-led Congress, particularly in the House, wants to revoke the updated nutrition standards for school meals that were championed by First Lady Michelle Obama. And they want the FDA to grant safe status to partially hydrogenated oil and artificial trans fats, moves which would put these decidedly unhealthy fats back into the food supply. David, what I want to ask you is, what do you anticipate will happen to obesity rates in the coming years?
Well, let me just say that there have been a lot of things put in place to combat the epidemic of overweight and obesity. And certainly the work of the First Lady, Michelle Obama, should be greatly applauded. But also the work of schools throughout the country and the way that many schools have changed physical activity. And even though many schools have lost physical education teachers, more and more of them now are finding ways to have children be physically active, even if it means in the middle of a lecture on mathematics, engaging kids in physical activity. It's happening in a lot of places, a lot of schools, where as soon as kids get off the bus, if you will, you know, they have an opportunity to work out and be physically active. We've seen a lot of progress in terms of children. In fact, at least 31 states have had a reduction in childhood obesity. The Child Health and Nutrition Act of 2010 changed what the Department of Agriculture could send to schools for free meals, making those meals more healthy than they had been in the past. Things like this are on the way that I think are making a difference. Robert Wood Johnson Foundation set aside $500 million of its funding to combat childhood obesity. The Action for Healthy Kids program, which I started, is really making a big difference in many schools and communities. So there's a lot going on, and we're seeing a change. There are some social determinants of health that are a real problem here. And you remember probably I served on the World Health Organization's Commission on Social Determinants of Health. And specifically to overweight and obesity, I would say that there are some people who live in communities where there are no safe places to play and be physically active, where they're not comfortable getting up and going out for a walk in the morning, which some of us take for granted. There are some communities in which there's no grocery store nearby that sells fresh fruits and vegetables and therefore giving them access to good nutrition. I think, again, that's where the Affordable Care Act was trying to head, was to really get us to the point where we view the social determinants of health, housing, income, safety, especially because there are some communities not safe enough for people to be physically active. Some communities don't have access to parks that are safe. So I think those are the areas where we have to do much more. So I'm hoping that we will be able to continue on that road.
Well, I am hoping that with you, and I know a lot of our listeners are too, when you mentioned schools, I was thinking about that not all parents are equal in their ability to educate or model healthy behaviors, such as physical activity and good nutrition for their kids. David, do you see it as a responsibility of schools to create environments that are conducive to helping children develop lifetime habits of physical activity and good nutrition?
Most definitely. I think it's a part of learning, and I think it's one of the best investments that we can make. If you allow me to put one plug in for the Satcher Health Leadership Institute.
Please.
We have three leadership development programs. One is a health policy programs for physicians and other health professionals. One is for community health leaders like mayors and to learn how to attack health problems at the community level. My favorite program is the quality parenting program. We take about 100 parents a year, and what they learn is how to enrich the development of children between 0 and 5. We take that for granted. Now, 80% of the parents in our community are single parents, but they want to be good parents. And what we find is that when we partner with them, they are really excited about the opportunity to be better parents in terms of the health and development of their children. And NIH has looked at that program and recently funded us to replicate it in 12 states. So I think we ought to invest in helping parents to be better parents, especially when it comes to how and when the brain develops, the impact of early communication, the impact of good nutrition. So there are a lot of things that we could change, because some things that happen to children are virtually irreversible in terms of the rest of their lives. So I think we ought to invest more in those early years and in supporting parents who want to be better parents.
There are many health authorities saying today that banning or at least greatly reducing the advertising of junk food that's targeted at kids would be the single policy measure that would be the most effective in reducing the rates of childhood obesity. All too often, parents are fighting a losing battle if their kids are being constantly bombarded with advertising which promotes fast food and unhealthy foods. Children have for a long time been the targets of junk food ads, and these occur alongside their favorite TV programs. But now we have modern digital technology, and it allows customized advertising, and the issues become more insidious. Facebook ads for junk food pop up on smartphones. Ads for high sugar snacks pop up at moments of heightened excitement when a child is playing an online game. David, do you agree with those who say that reducing or banning ads targeting kids by companies selling unhealthy food and drinks should be one of our top priorities if we're going to bring down the obesity rate?
I do, and I know that it's not difficult to implement things like that, because we always try to balance, you know, our concept of freedom and with what we need to do to improve the health of our people. But I do believe that we have a responsibility to protect our children. And I think that includes protecting them from being bombarded by unhealthy messages, if you will. And by the way, we have found that that children in certain communities, the minority communities, are more likely to be bombarded by certain of these messages, less likely to get health messages, less likely to have access to good nutrition, are safe places to play. So when you put all of those things together, you begin to see why the disparity in things like overweight and obesity. I think we as a society have a responsibility to do everything we can to promote healthy messages to children and to understand that there are disparities in health. And some of those disparities relate to disparities in the kind of experiences our children are having at home and in the community.
That's absolutely the case. The health disparities between the wealthy and the poor and between whites and people of color are profound. You've pointed out that more than 83,000 African Americans needlessly lose their lives every year from avoidable differences in the quality and quantity of care. What can you tell our listeners? And actually, if I may, David, what do you tell white audiences to help them to better understand what's taking place?
Well, there's some things that I tell white audiences that are the same things that I tell predominantly black audiences, because some of the messages have to be the same. But I have spent a lot of my career, you know, working with people who were predominantly white and solving global health problems with them. And so when I talk to white audiences, I talk with two of them from the standpoint of, together we've got to solve. This is not just a problem for black people. I mean, the health challenges black people are facing in this country are a problem for America. And so all Americans ought to be thinking about how can we together improve the health of all people, reduce the rate of overweight and obesity in all people. And many of the people who've listened to me over the years have come to me later and said, you know, I heard you speak and I decided that I wanted to do the following. And then they'll tell me what they're doing to make a difference in our society for blacks and whites and others.
When someone comes to you and says, I heard you, you inspired me, you motivated me, you helped me to see something, and as a result of that, I took these actions. What actions do you want to hear that they took?
Well, I want to hear that they have tried to implement programs to target these problems in whatever work they were doing. They had choices. Many of them sacrificed high incomes in order to work in public health, for example. Not a very high income profession, but makes a great difference when it comes to health outcomes globally, and certainly in this country, but globally, many people in public health are committed, and they sacrifice in order to carry that out. So I've come to believe that there are good people in all populations, white, blacks, Asian, good people, and I've spent a lifetime finding them to try to do good things together.
Well, we appreciate that very, very much that you've done that and continue to do that. I want to shift our conversation just a little bit to food and its role in obesity. Today, ultra-processed food, high in sugar, low in fiber, often full of chemicals, makes up 62% of the calories in the American diet. Now, we have government subsidies and... paradoxically, they end up lowering the cost to the consumer of ultra-processed foods. But we pay a very high price for that seemingly cheap food. Healthcare costs are now $3.2 trillion annually in the U.S., of which at least 75% is spent on the diseases that would be prevented if we changed our collective diet. That adds up to more than $2.4 trillion spent every year treating diseases we possibly could prevent. David, what do the American people need to understand in order for this to change?
Well, I certainly think they first need to understand the message that you just gave. You know, chronic diseases like heart disease, diabetes, stroke, etc., account for such a large proportion of the diseases that we live with and die from. And they are at least 80% preventable. They are preventable. And so we need to focus more of our attention and more of our resources on preventing these diseases. We have the best healthcare system in the world when it comes to treating diseases once they happen. But the problem is that so many people die needlessly of diseases that could have been prevented. So I think whether you look at it from the standpoint of the economics of care or whether you look at it from the standpoint of the humanity, we owe it to people to do a much better job of preventing, making sure that people do have the right information about the foods they eat and about physical activity. I have to say, you know, when I first became Surgeon General, I released this prescription. And so on this prescription I had, the first thing was physical activity at least 30 minutes a day, at least 5 days a week. Then we had good nutrition. And the focus there was on fresh fruits and vegetables. There's a lot of debate, as you know, when it comes to nutrition. A lot of areas in which people, you may read a book one day that says you eat more whole wheat, grains, et cetera. You may read a book the next day that says because that turns to sugar, we're eating too much of whole wheat. And so what strikes me there is the need for balance in terms of what we consume. But there's no debate about the physical activity and no debates about the importance of fruits and vegetables, plant-based foods in the diet. And I think we can know that. But we also have to continue to study nutrition and to try to make sure, especially that our children are exposed to the right foods.
Well, the fast food companies and the junk food companies have their own ideas of what they want to expose children to.
Yeah.
A recent study found that preschool children said that food served to them in McDonald's wrappers tasted better than the exact same food when it was served to them in plain wrappers. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's clear that the marketing of junk food to kids is effective, and it's playing a significant role in the childhood obesity issue.
Now, yeah, we're paying a tremendous price, yeah.
In order to ward off regulation, companies like McDonald's and Coca-Cola claim that industry self-policing is the answer. David, my question to you is, do we have any reason to believe that industry self-policing is the answer?
Well, I'd say two things. We certainly need more self-policing by industry. History tells us that that's not the answer, that as a society, we certainly owe it to our children to make sure they are exposed to accurate information about nutrition, but also that that we have a way of making sure that every child has access to good nutrition. And that's why what happens at the schools is so important, because children come from different types of homes and communities, and some of the parents are in a better position to oversee what their children eat and make sure that they get the right foods. But the reason I push so hard in terms of what happened at school, because for many children, unfortunately, the schools become most important in terms of their nutrition and their physical activity.
Well, I agree with you, and schools can play a tremendous role for good or in unfortunate cases in the other direction.
Right.
Some of the ways that fast food companies have insinuated themselves into schools can only be called insidious. I mean, McDonald's is proud of what it calls McTeacher's Nights. These are occasions for which McDonald's recruits teachers to work behind the counter and serve burgers and fries and soda to their students and to their students' families. The McDonald's Corporation provides uniforms and branded shirts for teachers to work behind the counters. Now, McDonald's claims these events are fundraisers for the schools, but in reality, McDonald's donates only a very small proportion. In fact, many cases, less than 10% of the event's proceeds. It's hard really to avoid the impression that these events are actually designed to use teachers to sell junk food directly to their students in order to create brand loyalty. David, how do you feel when you hear about things like this being done in our schools?
It's frustrating to see what industry can buy. You know, it's money can be used for good and it can be used for evil or for bad. And we see many examples of the kind that you articulated, where big business uses their position in our society and abuse our children, really. And I guess we're going to have to get to the point of calling it a form of abuse, especially when it leads to children being overweight and obese, and knowing how that affects them now, and that 80% of children who are overweight or obese as adolescents would be that way as adults. So this is without question an assault on the future of our children.
I remember seeing a child wearing a T-shirt that said on the T-shirt, "If you love me, don't feed me junk food."
Wow. Somebody needs to be congratulated for that T-shirt.
Yeah, I thought we should have those widely worn by kids.
Very good.
You know, I found some hope. The Canadian province of Quebec has actually taken a very tough line on food advertising to kids, beginning as far back as the early 1980s. All ads for food products that are aimed at children have been banned from all types of media, from radio, television, the internet, mobile phones, printed materials, signage, promotional material. They really do ban it across the board, and it seems to have really worked. Today, Quebec has by far the lowest rate of childhood obesity in Canada among all provinces. It's just an extraordinary example. David, what's keeping the U.S. from learning from the Quebec example?
Well, you know, it's interesting that the United States and South Africa, and I hesitate to say South Africa because I understand they're trying to reform, are the only two major countries that do not provide health care as a right. In other words, the health system is not viewed as a way to make money, as it is in our country, but as a way to keep people healthy. So everybody has access to care. So I think if we had a system that valued health more than health care, because in our country, I think health care is often too much viewed as a business and as a way for people to make money. The reason for health care should always be as a component of a system to promote health and keep people healthy. So I think our values when it comes to how we view health and health care represent major problems in terms of the way we deal with it. And so when you quote those figures in terms of costs in our health system, it's in great part because we tend to view health care as a business more than as a service. And I think if we could get to the point, and we would benefit tremendously if we could reduce overweight and obesity in this country and reduce cancer from smoking or from obesity or what have you, the country would benefit tremendously. But I think now we support business more than we do the country and its future.
When you say how important it would be if we viewed health care as a service rather than a business, I think that many, many physicians and other healthcare professionals go into this line of work originally because they want to serve, because they want to help people be healthy. But the incentives are so perverse.
Yes.
People working in public health are not reimbursed. Their income, as you mentioned earlier, is very low compared to people in specialties. Primary care physicians aren't reimbursed. Physicians who take Medicaid patients aren't reimbursed very well. There are so many ways that the culture of medicine today seems to, well, push people in the wrong direction.
Yeah, having been in and around medicine and medical education for such a long time, I can assure you that many, and certainly most of the young people who go into medicine go in there because they see themselves being able to provide a service. They want to be healthcare providers. And I think even in medical school, the culture of medicine has an impact which changes attitudes. For some people, it's a big disappointment. For some people, it's a change in their own values in terms of what they want to do. Because, I mean, you're seeing role models. And if you're in medical school, the most of the role models that you're going to see are going to be specialists. You're going to be taught intentionally or unintentionally that these are the people that you should be trying to emulate. And I think that's a real problem with medical education in this country. And even when we try to make a step forward and say, well, we're going to create a new group of people like nurse practitioners and physician assistants. And many studies have shown, for example, that nurse practitioners do a better job of controlling hypertension and in many cases diabetes, than physicians. The system will not allow them to practice, what they have made a commitment to practice and what they're prepared to do. But I can tell you, they have a lot of trouble doing what they've been trained to do and keeping people healthy. And then in the meantime, people wait for hours to see, in some communities, to see physicians because there are so few. And the same thing is true of dentists, by the way. Dental hygienists and others are trained to prevent tooth decay by putting on sealants and things. And yet most states do not allow that practice, independent practice of dental hygienists.
When you mentioned nurse practitioners, there's also a flourishing development of dental therapists, people
yes.
who are, they're not fully trained as dentists. They can't do certain kinds of surgery, for example, but they can provide a lot of the preventive care, a lot of the regular care at much less cost and be far more accessible if we would create a system that supported that.
That's right. And I believe now there are very few states where dental therapists, and some of those are dental hygienists, by the way, it depends on what they call them in different states, are allowed to practice and to provide care to children that they can't get otherwise. There are a lot of places without dentists, and there are a lot of dentists who will not accept Medicaid, for example, to pay for the care of children. So you have children going without preventive or help because of the rules about practice.
Well, those rules need to change. And are there things you would like our audience, the people listening to you right now, to understand or to do to help that to change?
I think there's a major message in terms of our experience as a country and our experience in the world that we should all understand, and that is prevention is, in fact, much more reasonable and economic than treatment. And as we said, again, an ounce of prevention is worth a ton of cure, not just in terms of the cost, but in terms of preventing pain and suffering. And there's so much pain and suffering in our society, much of it unnecessary, not just for the person, but for families. And we see it every day, and we have an opportunity to make tremendous progress in that area, and I hope that we will move to do that. It makes much more sense to do everything we can to keep people healthy than to say, well, if you get really sick, you know, we have the best specialists in the world, and if you have the coverage, you can get that care. So we see people every day suffering unnecessarily, dying unnecessarily, because we didn't put the emphasis on prevention and health promotion.
That we really need to put on it for so many reasons. You were speaking a moment ago about medical education. Today, less than a quarter of the medical schools in the country have even a single required course in nutrition. Of the 130 or so accredited medical schools in the United States, only four have a nutrition department. And even while we've been learning more and more about the diet-health connection in the past decades, the amount of nutritional education taught in medical schools has actually been decreasing.
Yeah.
David, what I want you to know is that here at the Food Revolution Network, we want to change this, and we want to see the healing power of whole foods nutrition, plant-based nutrition taught in medical schools. We believe most doctors largely ignore nutrition for the simple reason that they haven't been trained to address it. Mm-hmm. And we're undertaking a campaign. We want to get the National Board of Medical Examiners to include the proven role of whole foods nutrition in preventing and reversing disease in the exams that medical school students must take to become licensed physicians. We think that when the tests require nutritional knowledge, then medical schools will make teaching nutrition the priority that it should be in the first place.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's students know what's supposed to be on the test, and they make sure that they learn what they need to know in order to pass the test. We send a lot of messages in terms of what we require students to know and understand. So if nutrition is not a required knowledge, then the students view that as a message that it's not important. So clearly, part of this change has to be a change in medical education, as illustrated by a change in what's required to know in order to become licensed or certified.
David, what do you think would happen if every doctor knew the fundamental role that non-invasive, low-cost, health-building nutrition can play in helping to prevent and even to treat the major health ailments of our times?
Well, obviously, we'd have a major system change because I'm confident that the majority of doctors want to do what's best for their patients. They want to practice good medicine. But so often, all of the messages in terms of what's important, as illustrated in how we pay for care, or in the other direction. And again, I think that's one of the most important things about the Affordable Care Act, and that is that we started to reward providers for the quality of the outcome of their intervention. And I think that's a major step forward. We have a long ways to go, but the key word, I think, as I think about the Affordable Care Act, is that incentives. It started to put the incentives in the right place. And we practice to a great extent based on the reimbursements and the incentives that we get for the practice. So I think that's what would happen. I think that you not only do they have to know it, but also we have to make sure they know it's important by the way we reward and reimburse practice.
There is a story, I don't know if it's apocryphal or true, that in ancient China, doctors or the equivalent of doctors, what they had, were paid for keeping their patients well. If their patients got sick, they weren't paid.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that actually was the case, but there's a principle there that's reflected in that I think we really need to understand and incorporate in the practice of medicine today.
Yeah, I think there is certainly a very important principle. The one thing that we worry about, and I'll just throw this in because I basically agree with what you're saying, there are physicians who practice in underserved communities. They take care of patients who have been historically underserved. So their outcomes take longer to be as positive as we'd like them to be. So we have to be careful that we don't reward people for taking care of patients who are healthier than patients who have been neglected for so many years. That's the only catch there, is that we've got to make sure that we reward physicians who go to practice in underserved communities and who are willing to care for underserved population who might well be sicker, and therefore the outcomes may take a little longer to be positive.
Well, I very much appreciate what you just said, what you added. David, your lifetime commitment to preventing disease and suffering seems to come very profoundly from a lifelong commitment to humanity, to people feeling well and being well and taking care of themselves and each other and all of us. Having as healthy an environment, as healthy relationships with each other as possible. And I'm very moved by that. I appreciate it very deeply. You are an icon, obviously, to millions of people, and it has been a privilege and a pleasure to speak with you today and to bring your voice to our audience.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the quality of your questions and discussions. Very pleased to be a part of it.
We've been talking with David Satcher, MD, who has served as Surgeon General of the United States, Director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and is the founder of the Satcher Health Leadership Institute at the Morehouse School of Medicine. David, your decades of service and leadership have contributed to the health of millions and have helped to further a more just and a more equitable society for all of us. We're so grateful for your leadership, for your wisdom, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed being with you, and I appreciate what you're doing.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and you want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then check this out. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus ebooks, courses, trainings, recipes, and videos. And this empowerment package is available for a huge 50% discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.